Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. This week, several members of Congress announced they would not seek re-election. One Republican congressman abruptly resigned. The House failed to extend the Patriot Act. And what the likely merger of the New York and Frankfurt Stock Exchange could mean for financial markets. Joining me for the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup, David Wilna of NPR, Lynn Sweet of the Chicago Sun-Times and PoliticsDaily.com, John King of CNN. I look forward to hearing your comments on the week's news, which has certainly been significant both on the domestic and the international fronts. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
John King, the conservative caucus met this week. How are Tea Party Republicans affecting the whole discussion of the budget?
Hugely. In the House of Representatives, the Tea Party caucus and some of the other freshmen have essentially told their leadership, nice try, go back to the drawing board. Paul Ryan, who was viewed as this conservative who would cut more than most, came up with a package of cuts, depending on how you score it. It's 50-something billion or 30-something billion. And the freshmen, especially the Tea Party people, said, no, we said 100 billion. Go back and find more. And so they essentially kicked their own leadership in the teeth and said, that's not good enough. And it's a sign of pressure. And these are not traditional politicians, and it's clear they are not going to come to Washington and immediately retreat. We don't know where we're going to get in the end, but it's been fascinating to watch.
What kinds of cuts do they want more, David Wilna?
Well, they've targeted the domestic, non-defense-related discretionary spending, which is about 14% of the budget. And although the total amount of $100 billion doesn't reduce the deficit of $1.5 trillion that much, it would have a big effect on that part of the budget, especially because it would be over a seven-month period rather than a full year. It would come close to 20% of that budget, and particularly in the crosshairs are the Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of Education, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, for goodness sake, and housing programs, things that are in some ways a social safety net, in some cases, in other cases, things that people have just begun to take for granted. But I think that the leaders in the House realize that it's one thing to talk about cutting $100 billion from this budget. It's quite another to actually identify the actual cuts and make them.
Lynn Sweet, what about President Obama's efforts to find some meeting ground with Republicans on these cuts?
Well, I think you will see some of that. Obama's budget comes out next week. And in meetings with his budgeteers and knowing that the House Republicans want to cut, I bet you are going to see a lot of suggestions to reduce the deficit and to curb spending increases. I doubt if it would come anywhere close to the $100 billion that the most conservative Republicans, who ran on this as a single issue, demand. But I think that the Obama White House, I can't say exactly what it will be, but they will not have a budget-busting document sent up to the Hill.
And I think the Democratic president is about to, in a strange way, become the best friend of Speaker Boehner and Leader Cantor, because they're going to go back to those Tea Party people and say, look, we can't cut this deep because he's going to veto it. So we need to make a compromise. Because we have a Democratic president and because we have a Democratic Senate, we're going to have to negotiate at some point. But those Tea Party members are saying, maybe down the road, not now. We're going to put something bold on the table right out of the box.
That sounds too rational, I think, for what's going on in town right now. I mean, I think that Republican leaders in the House are riding a bucking bronco right now with these sort of fire-breathing conservatives who've arrived in the House and the people backing them. And really, it's a kind of a take-no-prisoners approach. They're not talking about reaching compromises. They're talking about making good on $100 billion, and the credibility of their whole movement seems to be based on that.
Well, I think you have members now who don't mind just voting no, 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 no matter how many incarnations it comes through. I also think that there is some movement, especially with the turmoil in Egypt, to besides talking about cutting domestic spending. The crisis in Egypt has put a spotlight on some of the international funding for Egypt and Israel, because Egypt is either the number one or number two recipient of U.S. assistance.
It's number three right now, just because Haiti got a whole bunch of aid last year.
Okay. You know, here's our first email on this from Marty in Syracuse, New York, who says, I fail to understand why Obama can cut the amount of subsidy for home heating for the poor and elderly. Can somebody explain this to me? John King.
Well, that's going to be a tough question for a Democratic president. And the White House response is that we have to find cuts somewhere. And
everywhere.
We're going to look and everywhere. And as David noted, this is the tiniest slice of the pie. To find real money, you have to do Medicare, Social Security, and defense spending. And so the first round of this, I'm going to use the term charade, that's a bit strong, but you're not going to get the real cuts unless you sit down and have a grown-up conversation about where the real money is. And so what happens then is that you have to look at these programs that have a popular base out there that are in many ways a social safety net, because that's where there's some money. The president got in trouble last year when to fund one of Mrs. Obama's healthy initiatives, they took some money out of food stamps. Now, what they say was that money was left over, it was not spent, that they put more money in that it was needed, but that's not how it was perceived in the community.
Right.
People said,
you're
cutting food stamps.
But there was also a pledge to because he got in trouble with the Congressional Black Caucus on this one. He personally went to a meeting, and he pledged that some of that food stamp money would be restored. We'll see what happens next week.
Here is a posting on Facebook from Shirley, who says it seems the Tea Party leaders who swore they were only about government spending were not listening to their members who had specific ideas on social issues. Will CPAC bring them together? David Wellner.
Well, I think that you do have a certain constituency in CPAC for those social issues, and people like Michelle Bachmann, the Minnesota Congresswoman, who's the leader of the House Tea Party Caucus, yesterday said that's one of the three legs of the stool that they're on, social issues. And you know, really in the House, what we've seen so far from House Republicans is virtually every bill that they've brought up has to do with health issues, and from the repealing the health care plan to putting all of these new restrictions on abortion. And we haven't really seen much of the budget cutting so far.
Interesting that at that conservative political action conference that began in Washington this week, you had more than 11,000 people showing up. And both Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney were there to some support and some booze.
They're selling books, Diane. You know, Rumsfeld's book came out February 8th. It was officially published, and Cheney has a book out. So this is a natural audience. I'm not surprised they showed up.
I'll pick up on that. When Newt Gingrich was elected Speaker of the House, he came on this program with his new book, followed by a whole cadre of news people. When asked, because he had suggested total cutting of federal funding for NPR and PBS, when asked why he was here on the Diane Rehm Show on NPR, he said, because she sells books.
Yes. And
that is the way it goes,
absolutely,
isn't it?
Absolutely. Because I don't think, you know, Cheney and Rumsfeld have been basically in seclusion. They and Rumsfeld has really only surfaced now with his book. He has a house in New Mexico and on the shore. And actually, I started reading some of the book. He, you know, part memoir, part non-apology, part score settling. But if you're going to sell a book, your first natural audience is 11,000 people who are a natural potential audience.
A number of young people, including Texas Congressman Ron Paul and his supporters walked out.
Well, there is a very interesting dynamic in the Republican Party right now and in the conservative movement, a page turning. Anything associated with George W. Bush is off the table. They've all celebrated the Reagan centennial in recent days. Ronald Reagan is still their hero, but most Republicans would agree with the premise that there would be no Tea Party were it not for George W. Bush not following through on being a fiscal conservative, that the out-of-control spending in Washington. Now, the Bush team would say 9/11 happened, we had to do Homeland Security, and the conservatives would say back to you, fine, but what about all the domestic spending growth? What about the Medicare prescription drug benefit? What about No Child Left Behind? What about things that we don't view as conservative programs? So there is a page turning, and Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney equal George W. Bush to a lot of those young conservative activists who think that is not the way back to the White House.
And what about walking out on Cheney and Rumsfeld, David Wellner?
Well, I think that Rumsfeld was never beloved by that many people in the Tea Party groups to start out with. I mean, he is a total establishment Republican. And Cheney, I don't know if people walked out on Cheney. But in some ways, I was surprised to see both of them go there, even though they do have books to flog, because they are establishment Republicans. This was the anti-establishment gathering.
Interesting. And you had some new indication that Donald Trump may run for president. Lynn Sweet.
He is a tease. He's a tease on this. We've seen this movie before, Diane. Donald Trump's never going to say never.
Although he did
when the cycle starts up.
Although he did inform the crowd that Ron Paul was not electable as president to some booze.
Pot meat kettle.
John King, he's anchor of CNN's John King USA, chief national correspondent. Lynn Sweet, Washington bureau chief for Chicago Sun-Times. David Wellner of NPR. Short break, right back. Welcome back to the Domestic Hour of our Friday News Roundup, this week with David Wellner of NPR, Lynn Sweet of PoliticsDaily.com, John King of CNN. Here's another email on the spending from David in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I haven't heard anything about cutting farm and ethanol subsidies by the Tea Party. Why not, Lynn Sweet?
Well, I think as we get into the budget cutting season, you will hear about cutting of these always controversial subsidies. What's interesting as we come into the 2012 election cycle, where the Democrats do not have a primary, but the Republicans do, is how seriously they will tackle it, since Iowa, which is the first test presidential vote state with its caucus, is the nation's biggest, often the biggest corn-producing state.
Here's an interesting one, because I think it may raise some hackles. It's from Josh in Oklahoma. Has there been legitimate and substantial consideration of cutting our international aid and international government subsidies. It seems domestic cuts could be taken off the table if the above were seriously considered. John King?
It's not that much money. So if you cut deeply, if you cut everything from the international aid budget, whether it's USAID and food programs, whether it's foreign assistance to Israel and Egypt and Haiti and other governments around the world, if you closed a lot of consulates around the world, you'd save some money. But again, you would not make, it would be pennies on the dollar when it comes to getting into serious deficit reduction. But there is an interesting debate about this now. There are people like Rand Paul, the new Tea Party senator from Kentucky, who says cut it all, or cut most of it anyway. And he's willing to say, look, I'm a big supporter of Israel. We can't afford it. He's at least willing enough to put that on the table and talk openly about it. It's not going to go anywhere. But there is a debate now in the Republican Party just on the question of Egypt and others. You have sort of the Buchanan, America first, keep all our money inside the borders. We're reliving that debate again with people who say, A, the money, a lot of it's wasted. B, we just simply can't afford it. And some people say, I'd love to do it, but we can't afford it. And other Republicans, like a John McCain, for example, saying, whoa, you have no idea how dangerous that would be if you did that.
Right. And I think that because they're targeting non-security spending, there's a big question about whether foreign aid is non-security. Because if you look at the Middle East especially, giving that money to those various countries increases U.S. leverage in the region, too. And especially when you're at a moment such as we are in Egypt, having that $1.5 billion dollar pile of money there is one way to talk to the military and say, you know what, there's a lot riding on this.
You may be able to talk to them, but I'm not sure at this point you can actually influence them, Lynn Sweet, but you may have another view.
Well, I think if we're talking about the turmoil in Egypt right now, we know how the White House is not on, the White House is as befuddled as we are. Last night, the White House issued a statement that basically said, Egypt, please clarify and let us really know what President Mubarak meant in his speech, because it's not clear what his next steps are going to be.
All right. And we've got to leave our Egypt talk for the international hour. I want to ask you about the latest resignation announcement from Senator John Kyle, the second-ranking Republican in the Senate. He's not going to seek a fourth term in office. Do we know why, David Wellner?
Well, Kyle, of course, being the whip, would aspire, you would imagine, to be the leader someday. But Mitch McConnell is showing no signs of stepping down. And even though Republicans do stand a reasonably good chance of gaining control of the Senate, in next year's elections, Kyle does not have very good prospects of moving up from the position that he's been in for some years now. And he may want to make some money before he hangs up his hat.
So Texas Senator John Cornyn, chair of the Republican Senatorial Committee, is going to make a run for that number two position.
And I believe Lamar Alexander as well, the former governor of Tennessee, now a senator from Tennessee. John Thune is the number three, I believe, in the Republican Senate leadership right now, and he's thinking about running for president. Will he decide to stay in and move up? Will that be his rationale, saying, you know, it'd be hard to run for president, I'm going to move up in the leadership? You will get, when you have a senior official like this step aside, you'll have some turmoil and jockeying, and John Cornyn's will be in some ways a referendum on his performance as the, you know, fundraiser for all those candidates back in the 2010 elections, and Texas trying to get a stake at the leadership table when right now you have Kentucky and Arizona and South Dakota.
And Lynn Sweet, why is Jane Harman resigning?
The job that she's going to go take as the chief of the Woodrow Wilson Center to replace Lee Hamilton is a very good job, rarely available. And I think she just took an opportunity that might not give a repeat opportunity to present itself. She is a specialist in intelligence and foreign affairs, everything that the Wilson Center centers on. So I take her at her word that this is just a very good opportunity for her to move on to.
And unfortunately, Congressman Christopher Lee took another opportunity, which was just nutsy. Really? Well, go ahead, Lynn.
What can you say about somebody who, a married man, who decides to have a fling, but does it in the most public possible way, where he takes off a shirt, puts a picture of himself shirtless on
flexes
the internet.
Flexes his muscles.
Well, I don't care if he's flexing or not. Just the shirt alone, shirtless alone. Who does that? I mean, how many ways were there bad judgment here? And then, you know, sends emails to somebody who he barely knows, and then
Craigslist.
Then it gets public. But he meets on Craigslist. What else can we say?
John King, what can you say?
The only thing I think I want to say is that he made his leadership, after making his leadership very unhappy with him for doing something so stupid, he made his leadership somewhat less displeased with him by at least very, very, very quickly resigning.
He had no choice, I would gather. David Wellner.
I think he would have been under gigantic pressure from his leadership to leave if he hadn't done so on his own. And leadership claims that this was his own decision, but it followed a meeting with the GOP leadership.
But remember, there are members of Congress who have been involved in serious scandals that have not left, and they're still there. So,
but this is a new majority trying to prove it can govern in the House. They've had a number of technical and procedural missteps this week. They're off to a pretty rough start over in the House, and they did not need this.
And what about the surprise announcement from Jim Webb, David Wellner?
Well, I don't know how much of a surprise it was that Webb decided not to seek another term in the Senate. He really never seemed to be quite a creature of the Senate.
Not quite comfortable.
He was kind of a solitary senator, kind of a prickly senator, whom I would approach to ask questions of and sometimes be rebuffed in a very sort of peremptory way. And I mean, it's not the kind of way you deal with many of the senators. I think also that he has other things that he wants to do in life and that he did accomplish one big thing in the Senate, which was to expand the GI Bill more than it's been expanded since World War II. His next big project is to have a thorough review of the American judiciary system and the especially the laws on mandatory punishments and review that. He says we are 5% of the world's population. We have 25% of the world's prisoners, and something has to be fixed.
I talked to him 2 weeks ago, and I asked him, you know, all your people are worried about you. You're not raising money. You're not raising your profile back home in the state. And he shrugged, and he said, yeah, they're mad at me. They're yelling at me, but I'm not going to ask people for money if I'm not sure I'm going to campaign. And he raised the point. He said, look, I just have to make a decision. Do I want to stay here for another 8 years? He viewed the 2 years of the campaign and then the six-year term. And I take him at his word. He wants to do something else. It's just not – he's not comfortable. He's like been the Navy Secretary. He's sort of a guy who likes to think he's in charge. And he's in a club of 100 that I don't think he found the work all that enjoyable.
All right. We've got lots of callers waiting. I want to ask you about the prospect of a German company buying the New York Stock Exchange. What do you think about that?
This is the last thing I understand from a technical standpoint.
Right.
I'm no financial expert. But what you hear again is the, wait a minute, what happened to too big to fail? Is this a good thing? Who is it good for? And most of the analysis seems to be that it's good if you're a financier, if you're a big money person in these markets. And is it good for the little guy, though? That seems to be the narrative that's emerging.
David?
Welcome to the global economy and the digital economy. I mean, we don't have ticker tape machines anymore. We don't have, you know, on-the-floor trading necessarily for huge exchanges of stocks. This is all done electronically now. And so it's become almost just another commodity, the whole exchange business. In fact, shares are traded on the exchanges themselves.
All right. We've got a lot of folks, and many of them want to talk about the budget. So let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Dayton, Ohio. Good morning, Ann. You're on the air.
Hello. I'd just like to know where in all this discussion about the need to drastically cut $100 billion that the House Republicans are demanding, where in all this discussion is what happened 2 months ago when it was Republicans who demanded that we extend the Bush tax cuts even for people over $250,000 a year, which would have saved us $70 billion a year, which gets pretty close to that $100 billion.
John King.
It's a great point on the math.
Yep.
The ideology of tax cuts, though, was the Republicans are still of the belief that lower taxes will eventually lead to economic growth. So that one was taken off the table in the short term. That will be that will be one of the defining arguments in the 2012 campaign.
And the mantra of Republicans is, we do not have a revenue problem, we have a spending problem.
Well, one of the things that you'll see is raising questions about whether or not you use the tax code to do social engineering and to give different classes of people breaks. That's part of where you might find compromise with the Obama White House in their quest to simplify the tax code, which is something that Republicans are interested in, too.
All right. To Big Pine, Missouri. Good morning, Jerry. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm a little confused about the Social Security issue. They talk about, you know, making cuts in Social Security for the budget, but the Social Security is currently in the black and is supposed to be in the black for several years. So when they say cut Social Security, they're talking about taking Social Security funds and using them for non-Social Security budget items?
David.
Well, a couple things. One thing is that they are not going to go after Social Security. That's a sacred cow, even for Republicans who question the wisdom of the program overall. The other thing is that I reported this week that Social Security, for the first time since it was founded in 1935, took in less money than it paid out. It was cash negative, as they say. Now, it has a $2.5 trillion trust fund, the bonds that it bought from the Treasury over the years, and the Treasury took that money and spent it for deficit spending. And now that money is going to have to start to be repaid because they're expecting that there's going to be an ever greater shortfall of revenues coming into Social Security over the coming years and a greater need to go to the general fund to make up the difference and cash in those IOUs.
John King.
It's a very bad combination at the moment of when you have high unemployment, fewer people are paying in the Social Security taxes, and the baby boom generation is starting to retire, so you have that math happening. But this is one of several adult conversations that have to happen in Washington, but most people say do it separately. Let's raise the retirement age, maybe do a couple other tinkers to help Social Security, and then have a separate conversation about Medicare and the bigger budget issues.
John King of CNN, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Sycamore, Illinois. Good morning, Hamish.
Yes, good morning. We need to reform the tax code. We spend over $100 billion a year. There's 14 volumes of over 1,500 pages each. It's too complicated. It needs to be simplified. Department of Education is $70 billion. They have 4,400 employees. They're not getting the job done. These are places where we need to cut. They need to quit looking at Social Security. They need to quit looking at the easy ways out.
All right, sir. Thanks for your call, Lynn Sweet. How much effort do you see going into reforming the tax code in this session of Congress?
I think it will be done. Let's put aside your comments from lovely Sycamore, Illinois, which is a lovely place, on whether or not the Department of Education is worthwhile. You have forces at work to make in simplification from both parties. You have Elizabeth Warren heading up the Financial Consumer Affairs Bureau. So I think this is something that people want to do. You had suggestions of it in the Fiscal Commission report that came out. So I think this is a time where people are looking at simplification. Yes.
I would say the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak, because every one of those special provisions in that gigantic tax code is there because there is some special interest group, many of them very powerful, that makes sure that those are there. Things such as the deduction for mortgage interest that's paid. The banks that lend all that money want that there because it's a real incentive for people to take out those loans.
And both the president and the House Republicans say they want to do it. I'm just not sure they want to do it together. And they need to do it together. So I suspect there might be some tinkering with the corporate tax code this year. But again, this will be a 2012 campaign issue, probably for the next president, whether it's a reelected Obama or somebody else.
And to Birmingham, Alabama. Good morning, Mark.
Love your show, Diane.
Thank you.
Guys, The Social Security withholding went from 6.2% to 4.2% this year, which is actually a 26% reduction in what we pay in. I'm a 57-year-old baby boomer, and I'm wondering, what are they thinking?
I don't blame you.
That was one of the temporary, this is not forever, so don't count on it in the long run, breaks at the Obama administration.
But how are you going to pay it back? But that's the question.
Well, it's the same question of how are we going to pay back $2.5 trillion that's been taken from the Social Security surplus.
But remember, there was a reason. This was to help stimulate the economy, create jobs. I'm just wondering, sir, did you spend that money on anything special, and what was it?
Well, I'll say more. I wouldn't mind paying 2% more, you know, or 26% more. I'm a baby boomer. If they said, hey, you guys, you're old enough, you're coming into the thing, pay more, I would be glad to do that. But this befuddles me that I'm paying less to a system that's got a death march.
There's another thing about that, too, which is that that 2% reduction in, or the 2 percentage points off of what's paid, that's on income only up to $106,000. After that, there is no Social Security tax on income beyond $106,000. And there's some talk of lifting the cap or possibly having a donut hole and having on income after $500,000 possibly be taxed again to make up the shortfall. That's under discussion. I asked several senators from both parties about it this week. They all sort of said, well, I got to look at that one.
Real quick, what's interesting is how little the Obama administration has been able to highlight the break that almost everyone who gets a paycheck for a living has gotten.
Lynn Sweet Cheese, Washington Bureau Chief for the Chicago Sun-Times, a columnist at politicsdaily.com. Short break, and when we come back, we'll hear from Doug in Fort Myers, Florida, and Annie in Friendship, Indiana.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight nearly 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. The latest on Egypt as tens of thousands of protesters crowd central Cairo. A suicide bombing in Pakistan kills dozens. And Sudan's president says he'll accept referendum results and allow the South to secede. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And here's an email from Renee, who says, I'm very tired of hearing politicians and reporters saying this portion of the budget really doesn't add up to that much if you add up all those things that are not all that much. It would add up to a lot. What do you think, Lynn Sweet?
Sad to say, it probably won't. This is why we're not saying it to be frivolous. It's just that when you're dealing with such gigantic numbers, things you need massive cuts from the massive programs to really make a significant dent in the fiscal situation.
If you got rid of every bit of non-security domestic discretionary spending from the budget, you would only reduce this year's deficit by one half, not spend one penny on anything that's not security related.
I do think the email, though, is reflective of the impatience in America.
Sure.
More impatience in America because every family in America, rich or poor or in the middle, have had to make very tough choices over the past 3 or 4 years because of the tough economy. They have had to set priorities, and they don't see their government doing that.
Now, what about that very thing? David in Design, where is he? I'm not sure where he is. David says, I'll believe Congress is serious about budget cuts when they begin to reduce their own operating costs, reducing their salaries, those of their staff, per diem for travel. Everything for the operation of Congress ought to be on the table. Also, didn't Jim Moran complain this very morning on NPR about the amount of space he has and the amount he's able to pay his staff?
Yes, one of the things House Republicans did do, one of the very first things that they did when they took back power in the House, was to reduce the budget for all House expenditures, offices, staff, and so on, by 5%. That didn't save a lot of money, but they said that was a good faith gesture on their part.
All right, to Friendship, Indiana. Good morning, Annie.
Good morning. Because we are all in this together, what would be impractical with the idea of cutting everything by 10%? The president could lead the way by putting 10% of his salary. Congress could do that just to get off dead center.
What do you think? Is that a possibility that would have an impact? You take 10% off every program out there, starting with salaries.
It would be symbolic. Obama has already frozen the salaries of the
government workers.
And he started with, even before that, just people within the executive branch. You know, it's hard to not agree with somebody who wants to see some change and see it now. But sometimes a symbolic cut that doesn't amount to much is just that, which is why you do it. They could cut across the board, but all programs are not equal. And one of the things that you do want from your government and elected officials is to look at each program and situation and apply experience, intelligence, and what local needs are about instead of having an across-the-board cut. But I understand this urge of just saying we want to do it, and we want to do it now.
David.
It would also be the elimination of many, many, many jobs at a time of high unemployment. And I think this really is coming down to an argument over whether government intervention, government spending, is helping the economy or hurting the economy. And economists generally say that government spending at a time like we're in right now actually is keeping things from getting worse. Republicans insist that it's government spending that's the cause of the problems.
That
right
is
now.
A core argument that the Obama administration is making. I went to a briefing this week with Transportation Secretary LaHood, who is talking about the money poured into road and transportation construction as the biggest jobs program in the United States.
John King, as a non-member of anything associated with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting or any of the other big programs out there, what do you see happening? Do you see Republicans and Democrats coming to agreement over cutting back, or do you see this strong push to eliminate, such as CPB? Do you see that succeeding?
I think the House budget will eliminate federal funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and programs like that, that the House Republicans would say it's not the right place for the government to spend money, or some of them would say we can't afford it right now. Maybe in boom times I would be open to it. That would be the House Republican budget. Then you'll get a Senate. Then you have to have if we get a budget, mind you. We don't have a budget right now. We're
right.
Operating under this mythical continuing
right.
resolution.
And in March 6th is the showdown vote, or the first
March
week,
4th,
on March 4th,
yeah.
on the old budget, which is still continuing. So it gets will also get more confusing as the two budget cycles overlap.
So you'll have you'll have the House Republicans will put their marker down. You'll have the Senate then put its marker down, which is a very much more confusing because it's almost parity. And you also, the most important people in Washington right now when it comes to these kind of decisions, big decisions, are the Senate Democrats up in 2012 from states they're worried about. And there are a lot of them. A lot of them in states Republicans just did very well in 2010 all across the country. A lot of Senate Democrats saying, what's the climate going to be like in the presidential year of 2012? And then you'll have a president who has a veto pen who's going to have his piece in this. And he will say, no, we're going to have the money for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And then the Republicans are going to say, okay, if you want that slice, Where do we get it? Where else? Where's the trade-off? And that's what we're going to go through for the next
and
several
months.
And
the other question becomes the line item veto. David, well,
yes, there's a push. It's a bipartisan push, actually, to give the president line item veto or rescission authority.
Right.
This is something, of course, that the president wants. But I think that in terms of trying to reconcile what the House and Senate are going to do, one group could be a key player. It's a quartet of senators from both parties. The four of them were on this deficit and debt commission, and they have been meeting fairly regularly for the past 2 weeks to talk about how to come up with some kind of a plan that Congress can follow.
A realistic plan.
A realistic plan, but one that would have no sacred cows, where they would go after entitlements and also after military spending as part of the solution. And I think that may be one path that this could go down. Because it's still bipartisan, they don't have any House members as part of this group, of course. But they do have two Democrats and two Republicans who are talking.
It's interesting. Jeremiah writes, I think it's interesting when I hear about cutting the budget that we don't hear the Tea Party discuss cutting our outrageous and bloated Defense Department.
Some do. Some don't. Some Tea Party members have said, let's look elsewhere first. But I would say, actually, many or most Tea Party members are willing to look at defense spending. It's not their first place to go, but they would say, yes, of course, something has to come out of there. It is not. They don't start by saying we're going to cut the Pentagon and then we're going to go here. They start by saying cut the Education Department and eliminate this program and don't give Corporation for Public Broadcasting money. Most of them, if you ask them 3 or 4 or 5 questions into the conversation, will say, of course, there's some money at the Pentagon, but it's not their reflex.
All right. To Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi, Randy. You're on the air.
Yes. I made $1,500,000 last year. I don't mind if you're doing in Texas. I mean, I don't have that problem. But you've got, it's like the higher the financial scale, the more complaints you get. I think it's the folks that's doing $5, $10, and $20 million, they just don't want to give back anything. And that's my comment.
And what's your comment, John King?
Nothing frustrates liberals more than President Obama ceding this ground. They believe he had the moral high ground. They believe he had the substantive and the mathematical high ground. And he ceded this ground in the debate, and nothing frustrates them more.
And here's another comment along that line from Richard in Charlotte, North Carolina. Why has the administration completely lost control of the debate? It seems the entire discussion of the economy is focused on the Republican and Tea Party points of cutting discretionary non-military spending. Where are the Democrats? No wonder they lost in November. They're just chirping us, too.
Well, part of it is that the Democrats are on the defensive because the job rate has been over at 9% and over for the last 20 months. So some of this other discussion from the Democratic perspective just seems like commentary, because you can't really have this kind of discussion about moving budget items, cutting, if it doesn't have an impact on what now is the number one issue, I think, for Obama's 2012 reelection prospects is jobs. It's
all
just
right,
harder for them.
To Fort Myers, Florida. Hi there, Doug.
Howdy. As a religious conservative, I'm offended that consistently for decades we jump to cut things that would help people like education and health care and don't focus more on the military budget. If 50% of our tax dollars go to the Defense Department and a fraction, like 1%, goes to diplomacy, we're always going to have security problems. It seems like what the United States is known for is having the best ability to kill people around the world, not the kind of diplomacy and education and health care that we should be known for.
David.
Right. If you take all of the military spending on the planet, the U.S. accounts for nearly half of it. And we're 5% of the population. So I think that there is questioning that's going on about what are we getting back for this? We're getting more and more entangled in more and more places. And I think there is questioning both on the left and the right about is this where we want to go? Where is the peace dividend? Are we ever going to have peace?
All right, to Cleveland, Ohio. Maria, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. My concern is about the Republicans and their judgment and their performance. And to what it is, they've been known as a party of no. The party of no mean they act like two-year-olds. Two-year-olds only know what that one word, no, no for good, no for bad. And what I'm seeing is the Republicans are failing to address or try to meet the needs of plain American people, next door neighbors. There's the one thing they want to do, and then they don't have an answer for it. Someone was saying this past week, what do you want to put in this place? Oh, we want to do this. They don't even know why they're there. They're just up in Washington to keep up a mess, to keep the United States divided. Now, they're not concerned about moving, being number one in education, health, or anything. It's just no, no, no. And why are you there? So they can have the best health care. One man said over the radio, he says, I pay $1,300-some a month for insurance. I pay my own insurance. I opted out of the program. Well, where is he getting that money from? He's getting it from the government.
Being the party of no, or mostly no anyway, helped them politically in the last election year. There's no doubt about that. Now, because they have the majority in the House, they do have a responsibility to put proposals forward, and we're seeing that it's messy off the beginning. Think about Thanksgiving or Christmas or any holiday dinner. The more people at the table, the more feisty the conversation. That's what the House Republicans are going through right now.
And we are headed for a real hour of the truth early next month when this continuing resolution, the stopgap spending measure, runs out. And if there isn't agreement between the House and the Senate on what to replace it with, there is the very real prospect of a government shutdown.
David, well, he's congressional correspondent for NPR, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Of course, David, well, we heard Ben Bernanke this week talking about concerns on Capitol Hill over the risk of inflation and fears of shutting down the government.
Right. And Bernanke sent a letter last month to Congress warning that it would be disastrous not only to have a government shutdown, but also to have a default on the foreign debt. This is something that is going to be an issue probably later this spring. There are going to be many Republicans who will be unwilling to raise the debt ceiling because government spending is going to rise to the point where it is going to have to be officially raised. If that doesn't happen, there's a prospect that the government could, at least in part, have to stop making payments, and they'd have to start prioritizing
surely
who will get the money.
Surely that's not going to happen. The Republicans are not foolish enough to let that happen.
Most Republicans say it is the last thing they want to happen.
Exactly.
There are a few Republicans, Diane, who say, we get pilloried. Everyone says, remember Newt Gingrich and the Republicans shut down the government. There are some Republicans, including Jeff Sessions, the ranking Republican on the Senate Budget Committee, who says, well, what happened after that? We balanced the budget. So some of them think it's a last resort, but they don't want to take it completely off the table. It is part of their leverage in trying to get cuts attached to the debt ceiling.
Right.
One other thing about Bernanke, too, is that Republicans have been warning that this quantitative easing, this selling of Treasury notes on the open market to keep interest rates down, is going to lead to inflation. And Bernanke tried to shoot that down in testimony this week, saying that, in fact, that really isn't happening. In fact, interest rates have actually been rising, which holds down lending. So I think that he's prepared to do battle with these arguments part of the warnings about inflation have to do with the idea that is the price of having government deficits, that prices are going to go up, when in fact that hasn't happened except with food and fuel. It makes it a harder argument to make.
All right. I want to take a last call from Palmyra, Virginia. Good morning, Priscilla. You're on the air.
Good morning. My comment is I've listened to the ladies and gentlemen talk, and every time someone mentions cutting something from a certain agency, they say, no, that wouldn't make a difference. Well, maybe that little bit won't make a difference, but I know from my own experience, you add up all the pennies, it does make a difference.
John King.
It does. And if we're leaving that impression, that's not the impression we're trying to leave. Yes, it makes a difference. If you're trying to save a dollar and you cut all those programs that we've talked about, you'll save maybe 8 or 10 or 12 cents of that dollar. You'll still have a lot more to get to your goal, is the point we're trying to make. You could cut all that non-defense discretionary spending and get 14 cents on that dollar that you're trying to save. The only way to get the other 86 cents is to have a grown-up conversation about Medicare, Social Security, and the defense budget.
Last comment, David Wellner.
Right, and I think that you have the prospect that you could cripple a lot of government operations by even paring them back 10 or 20%, but you would not solve the problem that everybody is complaining about, that we have such a huge deficit. It's only going after the entitlement and defense spending that you really get big reductions.
David Wellner, he is congressional correspondent for NPR. Lynn Sweet, Washington Bureau Chief for Chicago Sun-Times, also a columnist at politicsdaily.com. John King, he's anchor of CNN's John King USA and Chief National Correspondent for CNN. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.